Let's open up to Daf Tes Zayin Amud Aleph, and we're on the bottom of the Amud, and we're trying to answer the following question. The Mishnah says that we don't go out to a voluntary, discretionary war unless we have the dictum, the mandate from the highest court in the land. That's the Beis Din made up of 71 elders. And the Gemara wants to know, how do we know this? The Gemara took a stab at it. That was Rabbi Avo, from a pasuk in Bamidbar, which states that at the time of Yoshua going out to war, it was in the presence of Elazar HaKohen, and there are a couple extra words in the pasuk, and one of them, which is called Ha'eda, or Kol Ha'eda, seems to indicate Sanhedrin. So the Gemara says, no, that's a case where they asked the question to the Urim V'Tumim, and they interpreted the answer of the Urim V'Tumim as to whether or not it was worthwhile to go out to battle. That doesn't prove that we need the approval of the High Court to go out to battle. All we needed the High Court for was to oversee the questioning, the process, the ritual of asking and getting an answer, getting a response from the Urim V'Tumim. So at this point, we're back to square one. We really don't have a source for the power, the authority of the High Court to decide whether or not they will approve of going out to battle. So the Gemara now quotes a long, complicated braisa that tells us about the history of David HaMelech. And we're going to start today from the words Ella Ki Ha. So let's count up from the bottom of the page, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines up from the bottom of the Omid. Do you have it? And you'll see the first word in the line is Rachmana. And if your eye shoots across the line, you'll see the word Ella. So whenever you see the word Ella, it means that we had an unsuccessful attempt, and now we're going to try to come up with a better answer to the question as to what the source is. Now, it's a little bit confusing about this Gemara, is that what comes after the word Ella is not really an answer to our question, but it's going to give us a framework, and it's like an airport, and then the plane is going to take off from the airport. So now we're learning about the airport itself. We're learning about what David HaMelech's daily schedule was like, and we're going to see that because of a very unique position that he, and a role that he played as the King of Israel, he encouraged and initiated what we call a milchemes rishus, meaning a discretionary battle. Ki hadi Amar Rav Acha bar Bizna, Amar Rav Shimon Chasida. So here we have a tradition about David HaMelech. Ki nar haya talui lemala mimitaso shel David. Now a kinar is some sort of like a flute, not a flute, what do we call it in English? Like a ukulele. You know what I'm talking about? Those round things that have a hole in it and strings. Yeah. Is there a word for it? You have the art school. How does he translate
harp,
kinar?
I think harp says harp.
Harp.
Harp. Okay, a harp. Yeah. Okay. I don't think it's exactly a harp, but it's something similar to a harp in that it has an open space with strings going across. And David's kinar was hanging on top of his bed and serving as a kind of an alarm clock. You remember this from yesterday? And the kinar was tilted towards the north so that the northern wind would blow into this hole. And we're going to talk about exactly when the northern wind would blow. And at that moment in time, it would create music. At what point in time does this northern wind have a certain kind of a power or force to get this kinar to make the musical sounds? That's at Chatzos Laila, in the middle of the night. Ruach Tzfonis, this northern wind would come, and Hashem's bow blows, and it would cause this kinar to play the music on its own. Now let's take a look for a moment at Rashi, Dibur Maskil Kinar. So you'll see it's in the standard Shas Vilna, it's two lines up before the wide lines. You have it? Nekev Shalo, it's opening, Klape turned towards the Tzafon Haya, towards the north. Ubalila, during the nighttime, Ruach Tzfonit Min HaShevis, this northern wind blows. So we have to know something about this northern wind, because it's not just a meteorological, physical entity, it has a spiritual content as well. And Rashi quotes the Gemara of Baba Basra, the Kaimalon, the Gemara establishes, Arba Ruchos Menashvos Bechol Yom, there are four different winds coming from four different directions at different times during the day. So each wind coming from that direction would always blow during a certain time period. We start with the east, right? The sun rises in the east, and there's a wind that comes from the east. That's in the morning. When it says Baboker and Rashi, it means very early in the morning. Then, if you fast forward, let's say from 6 a.m. till 12 noon, that's called Chatziyom, Ruach Dromit. Now the sun is tilted in such a way that the winds are coming from the south. So we start from the east and we go south. Then we go towards the west as the sun is setting, Ube Arvit, towards the sunset, B'tchilas HaLaila, at the beginning of the night, then we get the wind coming from the west. Now let's assume we're in the winter period, so that nightfall is around 6 p.m. Then if we fast forward 6 hours, we're at midnight. And at that point, the sun is no longer available, and the wind blows from the north. And that's this whole system of one wind after the other, going from east to south, to west to north, is Kimahalech Chama. This reflects the way that the sun and the earth are situated, the relationship between those two bodies. Shamaleches mi mizrach lidorom, umidorom lamarov, umimarov litzofa. Vitanya biyavamos. We have a brisa mesech biyavamos. Kol osam arboim shana. Rashi wants to tell you about the special nature of the Ruach Tzfonis, you know, the northern wind. During the 40 years that the Jews were in the desert, they were called Nizufim. Nizufim means that God, so to speak, rejected them to some extent. There was a richuk, a kind of a distance between God and his people during this 40 years because of the sins that the Jewish people were guilty of at the beginning of that 40-year period. In other words, this Ruach Tzfonis, although it's most powerful with the emergence of night, of midnight specifically, but yet it does blow during the entire day. However, during that period of Nazifa, when the Jews were far away from God, they weren't able to enjoy the benefit of that special, unique, metaphysical northern wind during the daylight hours, but nevertheless they enjoyed the Ruach Tzfonit b'chatzi laila, at midnight. Alma chatzos laila eis nishivas oli olam. This is the natural time in which this wind blows starting with the midnight period, going up till daybreak 6 hours later. But pa'anim, if things are perfect, he menashevis af bayom. So we can enjoy the benefit of this wind even during the day. Except during that period of time of the 40 years in the Nazifa. Vehi, and this wind, ruach nocha v'yofa labrios. It's a very comfortable and beautiful wind, and we benefit from it. Vayom meir ba. And somehow the light of day, together with this wind, uplifts us. And the most powerful time, moment in time during the course of the day, when this Ruach Tzfonis blows, is when? Chatzos Laila. That's the natural time, given the way that the sun and the revolution around the sun, it's midnight. That's the northern wind. Now, what happened when the Kinar started making these beautiful sounds because of the uplifting, inspiring northern wind? Of course, David got out of bed. Miyad Hayah David Omed. It's interesting, the word Omed means he stood up, but the Mefarshim say that he stood up with a certain gusto, you know, like a Miskabek Hari, like a lion that jumps up, you know, the leap of the lion. He leaps out of bed. And what does he do? Well, I assume he washed Negel Vasa. He said some brachas. And then Osek B'Torah. He would dedicate himself probably for the next 4 or 5 hours to the study of Torah. And David HaMelech testifies about himself in Tehillim. This is in chapter 119, the longest chapter in Tanakh. He says, Chatzos Laila Akum. I get up out of my bed at midnight. Now, if you're in emergency medicine, you know, you may have a rotation, or if you're a taxi driver, at midnight. But David was not in any of those categories. But he needed time to dedicate to the study of Torah. It's fascinating that the Gemara tells us in Brachos, you and I would think he slept in a very deep slumber, as the body needs to, up until midnight. But the Gemara says, no, hayu misnamnim kisus. The Gemara says that a horse never really sleeps. It only sort of dribbles away. You know, it's in a kind of a state of a half sleep. So David HaMelech, even when he slept, he really wasn't sleeping in a deep sleep. But then he snaps out of it at midnight. The kinar blow, you know, makes the sounds. And then his workday began. Is anybody here, do we have any fans here of Dr. Seuss? No? Nobody? You remember the King Stilts? Anybody remember? That's one of my favorite Seuss books. I mean, my all-time favorite is Horton Hears a Who, which was true in the last election, but I guess the Hortons weren't listening. I don't know. Anyway, so Kevin Sha'ola Amuda Shachar, with daybreak, Nichnasu Chachme Yisrael Etzlo, and they started... crying to him about the situation, pouring out their heart. V'yomrulo Adoneinu HaMelech, Amcha Yisrael Tzrichin L'Parnosa. The people are in desperate need of sustenance. In other words, we're in a tough financial straits. Omalehem, so his first response was, L'chu v'sparnesu zemizeh. Now, there are two interpretations of what this means. First, we'll translate it, go and sustain each other. In other words, we don't have to go out to battle and conquer our enemies. We can solve this problem internally. How so? So one interpretation is that the rich people who have the funds, they should be supporting the poor people. The other interpretation is that they should be doing more business. You know, a lot of people are in export and import, so the money is coming from other countries. But if we beef up the economy locally, then there'll be more profit and there'll be more sustenance. Amrulo. Now here the Chachmei Yisrael responded to David with two different mishalim. One mashal is Ein HaKometz Masbia Es Hari. The little amount of funds that we have is not enough to satiate the lion. In other words, even if the rich people will give something to the poor people, that's not going to be enough. The amount of money they have to offer to the poor people is not sufficient. That's one mashal. Then he gives it another mashal. Ein habar v'ein habar mismale michul yoso. Now a bar is a pit. And in the old days, when they needed sources of water, they would bring water sources into a bar, and then they would take the water from the bar. However, in this mashal, there's not enough water that's being drawn from our local resources, our local rivers and so forth, to fill up the bar, michul yaso, up until the outer lip of the bar. That's one interpretation of this Gemara. Rashi seems to have another interpretation. Rashi says that when we dig the bar, if we want to fill it up, because somebody may fall into it, then it's not going to be enough if we put the offer that we took out and put it right back into the bar. We're going to have to introduce other sources of earth, clumps of earth, in order to fill up the bar. Because apparently, once they dig the bar, the offer, the ground, becomes very soft and it crumbles, and it's no longer that hard kind of substance that we can, you know, pound it down and fill up the bar. But the bottom line is that in this second mashal, the Chachma Yisrael are telling David that we have to go beyond the boundaries, the borders of Israel. We can't solve this problem internally. There's not enough funds, we don't have enough business, and it's impossible to expect that we will solve this urgent problem internally. We need something more drastic. Amalehem. So David finally gives in. He says, "Lechu pishtu yedechem bagedud." In other words, go out and fight a battle. Gedud means a military campaign made up of soldiers, and as a result, we're going to be able to conquer other lands, and we'll have new funds. And with this influx of funds, it's going to be like oxygen to give sustenance to our people. Now, here I want to add one footnote that I have here on my page. Maybe you have it on your page as well. And he says, "Ein ha-kavana shemidei yom v'yomo ha-yuchach me-Yisrael omrim." Don't think that this happened on a daily basis and this dialogue went on every day of the year. "Sha-yu omrim chach me-Yisrael David sha-om tzarech le-parnosa," and then they would go out to battle. Ella, but really what the Gemara is trying to convey is that midei boker, on a daily basis, the Chachmei Yisrael would come in, they would give an assessment and evaluation of what's going on. These were the special Chachmei Yisrael that are called Oskim B'Tzarchei Tzibur Be'emunah. Does that sound familiar to you? Where do we say that? In what context? Oskim B'Tzarchei Tzibur Be'emunah. Right, then where does it appear? Correct. Shabbos right before Musaf, after Yom Kippur, and he's quoting that here. And he says, "Kidei l'tya'etzi mo." In other words, they would give him a state of, you know, tell him the state of the country address and evaluate what's going on, because they were in charge of seeing to it that all the needs of the people were taken tended to. And they would be mityaetzimo. They would ask David HaMelech as the king on any issue that was relevant, that was pressing. What should we do? And on one occasion, they wanted to get the king David HaMelech's input as to what to do about this dire, you know, financial straits that the people find themselves. Now, once David gave the okay to go out to battle, miyad, immediately, Yoatzim v'Achitofel, right, they call in the military experts, and Achitofel is going to give them what we call, again, if you remember the phrase I mentioned yesterday, taksise melchama, you know, where do we approach and how do we attack them and so forth. And then it says, nimlachim v'Sanhedrin. So apparently, they needed the permission of the Sanhedrin, because this was called Melchemes Rishus. If you recall, Rashi in the Mishnah at the beginning of our Masechta says that Melchemes Mitzvah is when Yoshua has to conquer the lands. But now we're going into other lands, beyond the boundaries, beyond the borders, and that's called the Melchemes Rishus. For that we need Sanhedrin. And we need their approval. The Gemara hasn't again quoted a source, but now we have the framework. We know now that in the transmission of Rabbi Shimon about David HaMelech, they asked the Sanhedrin for their approval. Now I have to tell you that there's a Rashi in Masechta Brachos. I didn't get a chance to research this Rashi thoroughly, but Rashi throws us for a loop. Rashi says that Nimlachim v'Sanhedrin doesn't mean that they needed the approval of Sanhedrin, but rather they asked Sanhedrin for their spiritual backing. It doesn't mean that on a level of milchama, in order to decide whether they go out to battle, they needed the approval of Sanhedrin. Why does Rashi introduce the idea that they asked the Sanhedrin for prayers? Kidei, Rashi says, Kidei shisis palil aleihem. So Mitzvah Shem, after the Shir, I'm going to get out of Gemara Brachos, and I'm going to look up the Rashi and read it to you if we get a chance. But if you'll have the faith here, in my footnote here, he says, Rashi says, Kidei shisis palil aleihem. Well, if they only conferred with the Sanhedrin because they needed their tefillos, their spiritual backing, then our Gemara is very difficult, because our Gemara is using these words in the Melachim of the Sanhedrin to establish that we need the approval of the Sanhedrin, which is exactly what our Mishnah says at the beginning of Masechta Sanhedrin, that we need the approval, and if the Sanhedrin refuses, they veto the idea of going out to battle, and that's the end of the story. Here it says, according to Rashi, they needed the Sanhedrin to pray on their behalf, because these were the greats of Israel. Now, although I cannot answer the question how Rashi will learn this Gemara, I do understand what moves Rashi. Why does Rashi feel compelled to add the words, Kedeshi is palalu aleihem? Why not just say that they asked the Sanhedrin for approval to go out to battle?
Isn't that what Rashi says on this Gemara right here? He just says
here, Kedeshi is palalu, I didn't see it.
No, he says the other thing, the thing that's in our Mishnah. He says, no, he will shoot.
Correct. But I'm just wondering, how did Rashi and Sanhedrin, Rashi and Brachos interpret our Gemara?
Yeah.
So I don't have an answer to that question, but I do understand what bothers Rashi. Somebody once wrote a book called What Bothers Rashi. So in this case, I think I understand what bothers Rashi. Why did Rashi feel compelled to add these words, again, not here, but in Masechta Brachos, Kedeshi Yispalu Aleihem? Why couldn't Rashi simply interpret it straightforward that we needed the approval of Sanhedrin?
Is it connected to the next part? They add the Urim Bitum. If they are the Bitum,
excellent. I wanted to go backwards. You want to go forwards, and I'm going to have to address your question as well. But let's go backwards. Who was the one who gave them the green light to go out to battle? It was David HaMelech. Can the Sanhedrin cross swords with David HaMelech? That would be Moreh B'Malchus. So it's true, if the Melech says, I'm not sure whether we should go out to this battle or not, or maybe if there's a period of Jewish history where there is no Melech, then Sanhedrin takes over. But if the Melech has already decided that we're going out to battle, Rashi holds, then what do you mean we're going to ask Sanhedrin? We don't need the approval of Sanhedrin. We have the approval of the king. So the answer is that we're going to confer with the Sanhedrin to get them on board, but it doesn't mean that they're going to disapprove because they can't go against the king, but they'll be mispalali. Now, Reuven, you're raising another question. In the next line it says, v'sholim bi'urim v'tumim. Well, what does that mean? Why should we ask the Urim v'tumim if we already have an answer from the king? And not only that, I could ask even a more fundamental question. If the Melachim v'Sanhedrin, not like Rashi in Brachos, means that we need Rishus from the Sanhedrin, so why are we conferring with the Urim v'Tumim? And if the Urim v'Tumim says either yay or nay, and then the Sanhedrin says the opposite, what are we going to have? We're going to have a conflict between Urim v'Tumim is like a Navi. It's the word straight from God. So what, we're going to ask the Sanhedrin, and then we're going to ask the Urim v'Tumim?
Checks and balances.
So I'm not sure what you mean by check. I mean, I know what checks and balances is, but I think the answer is something else. What does it mean, v'sholim v'urim v'tumim? Sholim v'urim v'tumim means that we just asked Eviatar, right? What was that question? Achitofel, right? What was that question to Achitofel? How do we win this battle successfully? You know, we've already made a conceptually, a theoretical decision, a commitment that it's time to go out to war. But Ribbono Shel Olam, you can't just decide theoretically you're going to go out to war. There are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of stages here and a lot of answers to a lot of questions that we need. And we're going to get those answers from a military expert called Achitofel, and he's going to tell us under what circumstances do we really have a good chance, a better than 50% chance of success in this battle, and we'll come out victorious. Now what we need is an answer from the Urim V'Tumim to either, what word am I looking for?
Validate.
To validate. What other word can you give me?
To confirm.
To repeat what was said and confirm it. We need the Urim V'Tumim to give us the, you know, the extra Gishpanka, you know, that impetus, that confirmation that what Achitofel said is right, that this is the way we have to do it. Again, we don't need the Urim V'Tumim to give us the approval, the green light to go out to battle. Because if that be the case, then what's Sanhedrin doing here? Not only that, the Melech himself gave the approval to go out to battle. What, he's going to contradict the Urim V'Tumim? A Melech can't contradict the Urim V'Tumim because that's a Navi. You know, if a Navi says something, you can't go against the Navi. But the answer is Sholim B'Urim V'Tumim to make sure that we're going about doing it in the right way. Amar Rav Yosef Maikra, but now we come to brass tacks. We're still looking for a source for the approval of Sanhedrin, again in a case where there's no decision on the part of the king. So now we're learning Daf Tezayin Amid Beis, a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, also very long, complicated pasuk. I'm not going to give you an answer to the following question, but the pasuk that's quoted here doesn't exist. So don't ask me exactly how this happened, but there's a, I call it a printing error now, Gemara. It says here, V'akre Achitofel B'noyo Ben Yehoyada. That's not what it says in Divrei Hayom. It says Achre Achitofel Yehoyada Ben B'noyo. So that's a problem. But let's leave that out. I'm not gonna get into that. There's a whole literature about this. And then it says Ve'ev Yasar. And then it says V'sar Tzavol HaMelech Yoav. So we have four individuals here. We got Achitofel. We know exactly what he's here for. He's going to give the advice as to how to go out to battle and how to succeed and be victorious. But then we have three other individuals. Each one is going to play a role in this Melchemes Rishus. We have Binayo Ben Yehoyada, we have Eviyasar, and we have the Sar Tzava, right, the military command, the chief in command, and that's Yoav. So the Gemara now analyzes this pasuk. Rav Yosef analyzes this pasuk. Achitofel ze Yoetz. His role is to be the Yoetz. He's in charge of giving us the advice how we should go about winning this battle. And I'll prove it to you, he says. V'cheinu Omer, and the pasuk says, this is a pasuk in Tanakh, in Shmuel, V'atzas Achitofel Asher Yo'atz, etc. So we see clearly that the role of Achitofel is to be the Yoetz. Now, there's a long discussion here in a dialogue back and forth between the Rashba and one of his Talmidim. The Talmud of the Rashba did not understand why the Gemara felt compelled to quote a pasuk to prove that Achitofel was a Yoetz. I mean, all over the Tanakh, you know, I mean, that part of the history of Klal Yisrael and Shmuel, in Sefer Shmuel, Achitofel is giving Eitzes back and forth. So why does Gemara feel compelled to quote a pasuk? And the Rashba claims that what the pasuk is trying to teach us, and that's why the Gemara felt compelled to bring this pasuk, is why do we need an Eitzah from a human being, as great as he may be, and he's the quarterback, but we don't need him. Why? Because we have the Urim V'Tumim. If the Urim V'Tumim is going to confirm what he said, so why go through the entire process, which seems absolutely superfluous, of asking a human being when you're going to get the exact details from the Urim V'Tumim? So the Gemara therefore says, the Rashba quotes this pasuk, V'atzas Achitofel Asher Yo'atz B'Yom Mahem, because the end of the pasuk says, Kasher Yishal Ish Bidvar Elokim. And what this pasuk is telling us is that even though we ask for a Dvar Elokim, meaning we confer with the Urim V'Tumim, Nevertheless, we still want to get a human input. And only li'achar mikan, once we get the eitzah from the expert, from the human expert, then they would extract an answer to confirm from the Urim V'Tumim ke'at soso. Now what the Rashba doesn't tell us, I mean he does explain why the Gemara is compelled to bring this pasuk, but he doesn't really reveal to us why do we go through this? In other words, I understand the Havamin, I don't understand the Maskana. The Gemara quotes a pasuk to prove that even though they had the Urim V'Tumim and they would confer with the Urim V'Tumim, nevertheless they still needed a kickoff here from Atzas Achitofel. Maybe on a philosophical level you could perhaps suggest that Hashem wants man to take the initiative. Ultimately, if man is taking the right initiative, God will confirm what man says. But, you know, God created man and he has this responsibility. There's also a famous Ramban in his commentary in the Torah that there's Derech HaTeva, Derech Nes, and the Ramban says that unless we really need a nes, God would rather that we operate within the framework of nature. So this man is a military expert. He's going to tell you al pi derech hateva, and then we need, because it's a dire situation that Klal Yisrael is putting their soldiers are out on the line, in the front line, we need some sort of confirmation. Now, who is Benayo ben Yehoyada, or Yehoyada ben Benayo? He is none other than the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. He's the head of the High Court of Israel. And we needed to ask him for permission. Evyasar, Elu Urim V'Tumim. Evyasar is the Kohen Gadol. He's in charge of asking the Urim V'Tumim. And once again, the Urim V'Tumim is not going to give us the okay to go out to battle, because that we're going to get from the Sanhedrin, but the Urim V'Tumim is going to confirm the Eitzah, the sound advice, hopefully, of Achitofel, that it will be a victorious military campaign. Now the Gemara wants to prove that Benayo was in fact the Kohen Gadol. V'chenu Omer Pasukim Divrei Yom Benayo Ben Yehoyada Al HaKreisi V'Al HaPleisi. So the Kreisi V'HaPleisi is the Urim V'Tumim. The Gemara is going to explain the etymology here of those two words. Who is on top? Al means on top of the Urim V'Tumim, meaning who is in control of the Urim V'Tumim. That was none other than Benayo Ben Yehoyada, and he was the Kohen Gadol. The Lama Nikra Shman Kreisi Uplesi. Why is the Tanakh calling the Urim V'Tumim Kreisi Uplesi? Kreisi Shekarsim Divrehem. It's very interesting. Karsim Divrehem means they chisel it out. They cut it in a very irreversible way. In other words, in that sense, Urim V'Tumim is even greater than a Navi. A Navi, if he gives a Nevuah L'ra'ah, that something terrible is going to happen, he can rescind his Nevuah. And he could always say that the Jews did tshuva and therefore God staved off their punishment. So the decree is gone. But in the case of the Urim V'Tumim, that was final. There was no room for any reversal. That's called Karsin Divrei. What's Plesi? Shemuflaim Maaseihem. You know, it's the activity of the Urim V'Tumim, the accomplishment of the Urim V'Tumim is Mufla. Mufla means it's just amazing. It's interesting that throughout Jewish history we use the word kreisi uplesi for Talmidei Chachamim, because they also are muflaim. You know, they somehow come up with new ideas which are amazing. The Acher Kach, now that we have everything is set into place, we have the Eitzah of Achitofel, which was confirmed through the Kohen Gadol by the Urim V'Tumim. Now we have the Sar Tzavad, that's Yoav, and he's ready to go out to battle. Omer Rav Yitzchak Bereid Rav Ado V'Amri Le'odus say Omer Rav Yitzchak Bar Avodimi. My crow, what's the pasuk? He wants to offer a different source in the Torah, because again we said that the kinar would play at midnight on its own and wake up David. Is there some sort of scriptural basis for that? And he quotes a pasuk. This is very famous, this pasuk, because we sing it a lot. It's in Tehillim. Urach Vodi, Urach Hanevel Vechinar, Ira Shachar. David boasts about the fact that these musical instruments would wake him up. The other kings would sleep late. The Gemara says in Brachos they would sleep 3 hours into the day. So if daybreak was at 6 a.m., they would sleep until 9 a.m. But David says about himself, my schedule is very busy. I can't afford all this extra sleep. And Ira Shachar, I will wake up the morning. You know, even though it's still nighttime, it's midnight, I'm already up and awake and I'm studying the Torah, and that's called Ira Shachar. Okay, Rav Osai, we'll stop here. Wish everyone... So we have here a Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Ayin Gimel, and the Gemara says that the mitzvah of Hatzolah to save someone's life in three different scenarios. One is somebody's drowning, another is a wild animal is coming and threatening to take him away. A third is the listim of mortars, you know, these are attackers, his life is in danger. How do you know that you have if you have the opportunity to do so, you're obligated to save him? Talmud Lomer, because the Torah says, Lo Tamid al Damriacha, thou shalt not stand idly and watch the blood of your friend being spilled. The Gemara says that in addition to Lo Tamod, which is a lotaseh, do not, we also have a positive command to save someone. This is one of the rare occasions when your actions are mandated not only by an essay but also by a losaseh. So you got a double barrel here that upgrades it to a very high level. And it's from the pasuk in the parsha of returning lost object. The Torah says Vashevo solo, which literally translates, if you know the Hebrew grammar, and you will return him. It doesn't say you will return it, that you found his wallet. It says you return him. What does that mean, you return him? The answer is you return his life to him because he's about to perish. The Gemara says that it's not enough to derive the mitzvah of Hatzolah from an essay, from a positive command, because in the case of a positive command, that's what's called a chovas haguf. Again, if I had a whiteboard, I'd write this on the board for you. Chovas haguf means an obligation on your body, your physical body. If you can't do it with your own body, for example, I'm not a senior lifesaver, I'm not trained. So as far as the essay is concerned, of Hashavas Gufo, I can't do it. So I'm exempt from that. Any mitzvah Sheba Gufo, if I can't perform it on my goof, then I'm exempt from that mitzvah. But now the Torah added a lotaseh. When it comes to a lotaseh, lotaseh means you've got to avoid X, and even if it means that you can't do that physically and save him yourself, avol mitrach umegar agure. Mitrach means I have to take the effort, that's called tircha in the Aramaic, and megar, I have to hire agure, a hired worker. In other words, I see that there's a lifesaver here, he's going to charge me a bomb of money, but I can hire him to save you. Do I have to do so? It depends. If you talk about an essay, well, if I can't jump in and save you, I don't have that responsibility. But if you talk about a lotaseh, to avoid the violation of a lotaseh, you have to spend the last penny in your pocket. So now we have the following situation. You can't save him personally, but you can hire somebody to save him. Are you obligated to do so? Yes. How much money do you have to spend? The shirt off your back. Why? Because there's not only an essay, but there's also a lotaseh. Is that clear?
You have to have two of them, so that you can't just have a lotaseh.
Oh, you're asking the opposite. The doc wants to know that once I have the lotaseh, it means I have to spend my last penny. Why do I need the essay? And the answer to that question is that an essay always gives an extra status to a mitzvah. In other words, I'm going to get rewarded not just because I avoided a lotaseh, like the Torah says, do not steal. And I get some element of reward for overcoming my temptation. And that's a lotaseh. But here, I'm involved in a mitzvah. perhaps the greatest mitzvah of them all. Now, how do I know that this is such a great mitzvah? I know this from Ben Peturah. So if you fast forward to the third source on your page, Ben Peturah says that you have to give up the water that you have in your possession, or at least half the water, to save someone else's life. What's going to happen as a result of your giving up half the water? You're going to die. He's going to die also. Now, what does it mean he's going to die? So here there's a whole literature on this which is fascinating. I don't know if you ever heard of somebody by the name of Reb Chaim Heller. He lived about 50 years ago. I mean, he was an old man when he died, but I'm saying he died about 50 years ago. And he has a commentary on what's called the Sefer HaMitzvos of the Rambam, which is the Rambam's compilation of 613. And in a very extensive footnote, he says that what Ben Peturah has in mind is that there's always some remote possibility that maybe they will survive. Perhaps some miracle is going to happen. You know, they drink half the water, they get some hydration, and they're able to reach the shores, or maybe somebody comes by, hopefully it's not a mirage, and they'll survive. But imagine how far Ben Peturah is going with the mitzvah, the obligation to save someone else. You have the water. You desperately need the water. Give over half the water, even if it means you'll both perish, because you have to do your maximum to try to save him. Mind boggling. So if I were to ask Ben Peturah, if there's a good chance that I might perish by trying to save you, would I be obligated to do so? What would unquestionably be Ben Peturah's response? Yes, I would be obligated to do so. Not only that, Ben Peturah goes far as to say that even though it looks, according to all statistical probabilities, I'm going to perish, I got to do so. Why? Because the Torah says I can't stand idly by. Al yira b'misas chavero, he cannot watch his friend perish.
Now, by the way, Ben Peturah puts it, it doesn't seem that he wants him here. He says it's better that I should die. He doesn't.
Well, Rav Chaim Heller has a whole explanation, which is not for us now in the 10 minutes that I have with you, but if you'd like, we can go through Rav Chaim Heller together. That depends on how much time you have. It's a brilliant piece, Rav Chaim Heller. But he says it's impossible that Ben Peturah would say two people die when only one person has to die. It doesn't make sense. Okay. Comes along Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva has a pasuk. This verse is at the end of Sefer Vayikra. And it says, V'chei achicha imach. What does imach mean? Let your brother live, what's imach? With you. So here we have to know how Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law, understands the words of the Mikra, meaning the Torah Shebetzav. The word imach, or im, means tafel. Does anybody here know what the word tafel means? Anybody?
Secondary.
Secondary, exactly. There's primary and there's secondary. Primary is called ikar, and secondary is called tafel. When you say something that's im, it's with you, it's secondary to you. You are primary. And based on this verse, and Rabbi Akiva's interpretation thereof, he formulates one of the most famous principles in Jewish law. And since we're studying Jewish law, we should formulate the principle: Chayecha kodmin l'chayei chavercha. Your life comes first. Does that mean that Rabbi Akiva thinks I can decide that my blood is redder than his? Well, take a look in the second source of your page. The Gemara says that you cannot say that your blood is redder than his, and that's how the Gemara derives the conclusion that you have to be willing to give up your life rather than kill somebody. So if you take a look at the second source, which is the Gemara in Sanhedrin Ayin Dalet, the Gemara asks, what's the source for the fact that I don't kill someone? And the Gemara says this is about six lines up, let's say seven lines up before the end of the page. I mean, that part of the page. Svaro! There's a compelling Svara logic. And the Gemara tells us a story about a person who came in front of Rabbah, or Rava, different. And he said to him that Mari Durai, the governor of, you know, this state, you know, the pirates, he said to me, Zeal, go ahead, Katli Lepanyan, kill so and so. Vi Lav, and if you don't kill him, Katli Lechal, I'll kill you. So what should I do? So Rava says to him, Liktulach, you'll be killed. Let yourself be killed. Velo tiktum. Why? Because of a svara. Who says that your blood is redder than his? Therefore you should be passive. Now Rabbi Akiva cannot contradict that Gemara because the Gemara uses that logic as the source for one of the three cardinal sins, which do not allow you, even if at pain of death, to violate that sin, and that's Shvichas Dovim, killing someone. So how can Rabbi Akiva formulate the principle Chayecha Kodmin L'Chay Chavecha, that your life comes first? What does that mean? Your blood is redder than his? How can he make such a statement? Anybody? Let me formulate the question again. Maybe if I ask the question a second time, I'll evoke a response. On the one hand, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, on Daf Ayin Daled, that you can't kill someone to save yourself, because if you did so, you would contradict a fundamental logical principle that says you cannot make that determination and claim that your blood is redder than his. Comes along Rabbi Akiva, in the Gemara Bava Metzia, a different part of Shas, and he says that you will not save him at the expense of your life. You will not give up the water to save him, because Chayecha Kodmin L'Chay Chavercha. If I said that 1,000 times, it wouldn't be enough. Because this is such a fundamental principle in Jewish law. You have to know it in the middle of the night. If I wake you up in the middle of the night, this is Burzon here waking you up. You think I'm waking you for sleepers? No, I'm not waking you for sleepers. I'm waking you up to hear you say the following 4 words that came out of Rabbi Akiva's mouth some 2,000 years ago. Chayecha kodmin l'chayei chavercha. Your life comes first. What does that mean? My blood is better than his? Doc, what were you going to say? Stuart, you were going to say something, no?
But it's the opposite then also.
What? No, come on, don't be embarrassed. We're all friends here. He's a physician, so he has to know the answer to this question.
It sounds like one's an ase and one's a low.
Okay, that's one point. Anybody else?
So one's a passive. He's passive. He's doing nothing. He's not kidding you.
Excellent. What else? Whose water is it, Rav Osai?
Right, but then it's also the opposite.
Am I saying that his blood is redder than mine? Or my blood is redder than his? Chayecha Kodmin?
Yeah,
I'm drinking whose water? Am I grabbing his water and saying, no, what?
It's your own. You say you're not allowed to give up your own life.
Yeah, it's my water. This water is my source of life. Just like oxygen gives me life, water, H2O gives me life. In this situation, I should give up the water? That water represents life for me. If I were to give him the water, I'd be making a statement that his blood is redder than mine. I can't make that determination. And therefore, says Rabbi Akiva, go ahead and drink the water. Now here we have a major controversy. I know, Rabbi, my time is up. I'm gonna end. I saw the rabbi, I got the message. Here's the crux of the matter, and I want you to think about this. Rabbi Akiva says, drink the water. Is it A or B? Did he say A, you're allowed to drink the water? Or did he say B, you're obligated to drink the water? The difference is, if he said you're allowed to drink the water, then you have two options. You can either give the water to him, and you'll perish, he'll survive. Or you can decide, because you have the green light to do so, it's your water, you can drink the own water. The other possibility is that Rabbi Akiva said, no, you have the wherewithal, the means to save yourself, you're obligated to save yourself. And my friends, this question about how to understand Rabbi Akiva is going to make a ripple effect throughout the halachic literature up until and beyond the moment that we're sitting here today. Because the question is, am I allowed to risk my life to save others? Stories of Chayalim who did so in the Israeli army, and many other stories in medical ethics and the history of the Jewish people. Do I have license to go beyond the letter of the law and give up my life for the sake of someone? I want to take this opportunity to wish everyone a Shana Tova, and thank you very much. I got to keep you in suspense here. They gave me 10 minutes, you know.
I'm an older. I'm going to save my grandchild. I'm no future. I'm old. So
right.
What do I do?
Good question. We'll try to touch it next time. Okay. Yes?
I was wondering if you could say that.
You want to come out this way?
The Halachah Shiloh, the rabbi brought up about the deflecting the grenade.
Oh, yeah. Would that be with the Halachah Shiloh?
Obviously, the idea would not only that it would be mutter, but according to the Hayaka Kodam, as far to say you'd be obligated to say push away.
Oh, once you accept. Once you accept, yeah, for sure. I'm absolutely convinced that the Chazon Ish was mandating us to push the. The hang grenade.
Wow. Yeah.
But again, keep in mind that in that case of the Chazon Ish, it's the Rabbim against the Yochid. The Chazon Ish goes out of his way to emphasize it's twice. There are only two soldiers on the right.
Over there.
There are five on the left. I mean, I'm making up the numbers, but
yeah.
He calls the Rabbim and Yochid. In that case,
you're on Sunday. It's a shift.
Yeah, it's a shift. Oh, Sunday. No, I'm not here on Sunday. Sunday's every Rosh Hashanah. That's why I wish everyone a good convention deal, because I can't be here on Sunday. I don't know. Maybe I could.
No. That's why I'm asking.
I'd have to ask my wife for special permission. But, Sunday is a complicated day. I'm not going to give you the long list of things that we have to do on Sunday. I can tell you how many guests we have on Rosh Hashanah.
I'm not sure.
Oh, you're not sure about Wednesday?
I'm not sure myself. Wednesday. Then we're heading out to the States for.